we have episode 551 of The Critical Myth. I am John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and yes, as promised, we did find John. However, we seem to have misplaced our bronze thumb now, so unfortunately, I will not get to talk with him about our new favorite show, but I promise not to make a federal case out of it.
This is Gary from Jacksonville, and I would like to rescind my news from the last show about the new Star Trek TV series. I found out it was all just a lie, a damn dirty lie. No.
Yeah, I was going to burst your bubble on that, but it looks like somebody else did for me, so there we are. I'm obviously back, and unfortunately, there can only be three, apparently, at least this week. But we are going to be talking about the best... or shall I say the highest and lowest scored shows of the week. I don't want to say worst shows of the week, because there were things that were much worse. We just choose not to talk about them.
Yeah.
So the highest and lowest scored shows of the week. And before we do any of that, Edmund, if you don't mind giving a disclaimer.
Absolutely. As is always our policy, we like to feel like we can talk about just about anything on these shows. So you will most likely be horribly spoiled if you haven't watched them yet. But as ever, we try and give you a week or even more to catch up before we do that to you.
That's right, and we are going to go ahead and start off here with the top three of the week. And, well, let's see. First off is a show that we can all talk about. That's so rare sometimes. And I will say that the number three slot this week was a matter of literally just last-minute scores changed the number three slot right before we started recording. So it's one of those weeks where, there's a lot of contenders. But this one came out on top, or at least number three, and that would be Arrow. Here's the promo.
Oliver Queen is a man destined to be alone. Your city will turn on you. You will be scorned and hunted and then killed. I can give you a whole world to save.
Maybe I should be Ra's al Ghul.
Arrow returns with an all-new episode Wednesday, March 18th.
And that would be Arrow, Season 3, Episode 16, The Offer. Oliver returns from Nanda Parbat, with Malcolm and Diggle after hearing... Ra's al Ghul out and questions his mission. Meanwhile, a new villain Murmur steals a shipment of industrial diamonds, and Quentin turns against Arrow after learning the vigilante knew the truth about Sarah's death. Boy, did someone put that together in a rather odd way. But anyhow, this one came in at an average of 8. So there you go, right on the above average scale. And it, scores were anywhere from 7 to 9. Bronze Thumb actually gave this one an average 7. Nadine gave it an exceptional 9, and the rest of us were right at the average of 8. So there we are. Gary, what are your thoughts on this particular episode?
I kind of liked it. I was, after the meeting, the whole issue with Ra's al Ghul, I was expecting almost more of a much more of a placeholder episode than we ended up getting. I enjoyed that they introduced a new villain for us to look at, look after, as sort of Ra's al Ghul is at least kind of closed out for the time being. I particularly enjoyed Quentin's whole discussion with Arrow about Sarah's death. I thought that was an incredible scene, and for the first time, I had the sense that that Oliver understands some of the costs for doing what he's doing. It never seemed quite clear to me that he wasn't just sort of playing around until that moment when he was just standing there taking that speech, and it seemed to me like it hit home harder than his typical, oh, we can't talk about Sarah or stuff like that, when he was trying to keep everything quiet as to who killed her. But now it seemed that it twisted a little bit different, or at least that's what I took most away from this episode. What was your best parts?
How about you, Edmund?
Well, certainly for me, I mean, getting Detective Captain Lance sort of more in the loop, I thought was a very good idea. I mean, it's a bit of a TV trope to have this thing of, we can't tell people, and keeping it a secret, and getting all that stuff out in the open, and also the conflict that it certainly generated after Lance had sort of come around, but certainly given his feelings in the first season, it certainly made sense that he would shift back to having his issues with Arrow. Of course, I still just want to have him come out and call him Oliver at some point, but that's just me. And on You know, there was a little bit of going back to the standard operating procedure in terms of having the new villain coming in and dealing with that which I thought made sense after the whole Roz tangent, shall we say, and also just the fact that I wasn't necessarily expecting as much of a placeholder episode as Gary was, but I didn't, you know, I certainly didn't think Oliver was going to decide immediately. There's going to be some complications about all this before it comes to a head.
Yeah, I think that was what was most surprising to me as well, was that just the fact that he made the decisions. I mean, it's one of those things where I guess the fact that he did make it so quickly was made it fairly obvious what he was going to say. I guess in that regard, I can understand why it would be a bit of a – for Bronstam, I don't want to speak for him because I don't know if this is why he was disappointed. But I could see why putting the choice out there when there really is no way that you're going to go with – that Oliver's going to go for it is a little bit of a cheat. At the same time, what's interesting isn't whether or not Oliver says yes, it's what happens when he says no. And we are already getting some indication that, you know, this was one of those, I'm giving you an offer that you cannot refuse type of situations, because the minute that he says no, they basically come out and say, are you sure? Are you really sure that's what you wanted? Okay, well, now we're going to have an issue. But also, just the fact that in this episode he spent so much time, you know, thinking about what did this really mean for him, you know, like for his mission and everything else. So I liked that. The fact that they were willing to explore that was good. So I mean, everybody seemed to. Well, I shouldn't say everybody, but average being the lowest score on this one is pretty impressive. Like you said, it could have been a placeholder episode. It could have easily been a filler episode, and that's not at all what we had here. Gary, anything from this episode as far as DC lore that's worthy of mention?
The villain didn't quite seem as I don't think there's an exact analog to him, I'll have to actually read back a little bit more, but nothing strikes out at me. But as a side note, in the comics, you know, there always was a Black Canary was never a single character. They always did have her split between two different people. Originally, it was actually a mother and a daughter. But the family link is still a nice little homage that I haven't mentioned before. But other than that, Ra's al Ghul is not, in the comics, is never an Arrow villain. He's always a Batman villain, very much so. So it was an interesting twist on it, but given the grimness of this particular version of Arrow, it's still, he can take the place of Batman, I suppose.
Yeah, I'm fairly sure that everybody realized that they're just trying to, in many ways, have a Batman show without Batman.
Yes.
So I mean,
because this exact storyline played out in the Batman comic books, where he was offered the position of head of the League of Assassins. Why? Because he can do amazing things when he has them under his control. So it was the same pitch. It was I've heard this offer before, and the result was the same.
Exactly. Exactly. All right. Anything else, Edmund, about this episode?
No. Well, I guess you touched on it, but certainly, yeah. I mean, that ending certainly made it clear that just because you say no doesn't mean Roz is going to just accept your refusal. So, and certainly given the tensions that had already been built up with him and Lance, looks like Roz is taking what could be a very effective tactic to bring him around.
We shall see. All right, well, that brings us then to our number two show for the week, and this was far less ambiguous in terms of which show was going to get those honors. And this one goes to Black Sails, and here's the promo.
I will be the end of piracy in this place, and it begins tonight.
I cannot stand before you and claim to be without sin. But I ask you not to judge me.
Chow Sound is sleeping with one eye open and a knife under its pillow tonight.
This ship is the only way we live here alive.
I
right now, Flint's plan is the only plan.
Black Sails. Watch an all-new episode Saturday at 9 or catch up anytime with Stars on Demand or Stars Play.
All right, Black Sails, Season 2, Episode 9, 17. Dot. Flint and Miranda come to grips with their past. Okay. Bonnie makes clear her intentions to Rackham. Vane collects a huge prize, and Eleanor issues a declaration of war.
Yes, indeed.
Oh, boy. Yeah, and this episode came in at an 8.5. Score is coming in between 8 and 9, so definitely a deserving number two episode. But so I actually wound up giving it the lowest score out of the three, which is kind of surprising. Bronslam gave it the 9. For me, this episode really, it felt like a lot of setup for the finale, which is fine. Mm-hmm. Vane did kind of make good on his promise to attack from the water. But the main thing in this one, which is why I thought it was funny that Flint and Miranda were coming to terms with their past, really,
yes.
that's hard to do when there's a bullet in your head.
Yeah.
And yes, Miranda's death in this episode was a huge shock, I think, to everyone. Once again, reinforcing what was kind of foreshadowed earlier in the season. You can try to have your best intentions speak for you, but events can sometimes go out of your control. And that's exactly what happened here, to say the least.
Yeah, and certainly, I mean, the circumstances, just as it looked like they might be reaching the accommodation, and then things start spiraling, and the right hand man steps in and makes a decision, basically. But I guess for me, I certainly acknowledge that there was a rather obvious amount of setup going on, but I thought they still did a very good job of pushing things along from where they'd ended in the previous episode, where there had been I wouldn't say quite a cliffhanger, but certainly where they left things very uncertain, and I thought they did a good job of still pushing the plot forward giving us there are a lot of times in this show where they have the mix between they have to juggle between the piratey fighty stuff and then the politics, and this was one of the rare episodes where they actually managed to do both in the same episode rather than concentrating on one or the other, and certainly as a lead in to the finale, and both giving us a lot of action, giving us a lot of plot, but still leaving things still up in the air and tenuous enough to where you can really see it going in any number of directions. I thought it was a very good mix of both setup and pushing forward.
Yeah, well, I really feel like this was almost the first half of the finale before, if you really look at the overall structure of things, it really isn't like they had a bunch of stuff going on and then out of nowhere went, oh yeah, let's have it all wrap up in one episode. That's not the way that this show typically works.
Mm-hmm.
And for good reason. I mean, it is an ongoing serialized narrative, and it works very well that way.
Yeah, actually, it was as you were giving the title, it was something I'd thought of a couple of shows ago, but forgot to mention. Yeah, I almost feel like we could just put chapter in front of each of the numbers, just because that's certainly the structure it feels like.
Exactly, they're going to get to a conclusion in the next episode for the season, but they're going to pick right up where they left off in the third season premiere. So,
exactly.
It really doesn't matter. It's just chapter to chapter.
Yeah.
And yeah, think about it. This would be one heck of a chapter to read, that's for sure.
Yes.
All right. Well, that means that we can move on to our number one show for the week. And this is becoming a bit of a pattern. I'm going to have to talk to somebody about this. I don't know that I'm happy about this. But we shall see. It's, as many people are rather familiar by now, Better Call Saul hits the number one slot this week. And I'm not going to run a promo because, oddly enough, There are no real promos available out there for this show.
Hmm.
I think they get wiped clean off of the usual sources. And so, yes, we're just going to launch right into it. And so, Edmund, if you could do a recap, please.
Absolutely. This was Better Call Saul, Season 1, Episode 8, Rico. Jimmy shows Chuck that he's willing to do almost anything to win a case, even if it means getting his hands dirty. And yeah, since Jimmy did have to go dumpster diving in that episode, that's AMC for once being very to the point. I did actually manage to chat with Bronze Thumb a little bit about this before he had to take his leave at the end of last episode, and we both gave it a 9. We are still very much enjoying where they've gotten to with this show, and it's interesting how they really managed to give us it has some of the flavor of Breaking Bad, but it's still very much its own beast. Jimmy's starting to make his way in the world and trying to grab whatever success he can. You're seeing the tensions between the integrity and the desire to do what as they say, whatever it takes to win. And certainly with the dumpster diving and him trying to write out demand letters on toilet paper, there is the comedic elements. It is definitely a show that's not as dark and nasty as the later seasons of Breaking Bad was. But at the same time, there's still some heavy stakes going on in terms of where his life's at and where he's trying to be, and also some of the family relations. I mean, the whole thing with his brother Chuck that started out as certainly being played more for comedy of his brother who was the top lawyer who then got this allergy to electricity, which is psychosomatic, and how Jimmy's starting to bring him along and bringing him into this case has actually started to turn the corner there. So it's a very nice mix of plot and character study and some as we've come to expect from this group, Vince Gilligan and pals, some very good character work and writing and acting going on. So it's after that shaky beginning, Better Call Saul has really turned into the show that I don't think any of us knew exactly what it was going to be, but what it's turning into is very enjoyable.
Yeah, it certainly seems like the show found itself pretty quickly, which is nice. So I suppose at this point, the season is kind of drawing towards its conclusion already, right? It is a relatively short first season.
Yeah, I think it is one of those 13 episodes. They're 8 in, 5 to go. We're certainly where they're at right now. I mean, this case he's just entered into against the assisted care facility certainly has the feel of the one that's going to drive him to the end of the season. Certainly you get somebody like Dennis Boutsakaris in as the opposing counsel. That's a pretty heavyweight actor. So I'm pretty sure he's there to be around for a while and provide quite a bit of conflict.
So I guess we'll just have to see whether or not this one rises to the occasion for the end of the season. The amazing thing to me is that we started off with a ridiculously low number.
Yes.
What was it? The pilot got a 5, okay, which is essentially down right at Allegiance territory. So way down at the bottom of the list. And right now, Better Call Saul, with only a few episodes left, is at a season average of 8.3. Which puts it in the number 7 slot for the entire season.
Yep.
And definitely in the top 10, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
So it went from the dead bottom to top 10 over the course of how many episodes? 8?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So...
Oh, yeah. No, well, I mean it was the oddest thing of where... Particularly those first two episodes, and I'm pretty sure I said it at the time, it really felt like they could have been just condensed into one. I was really thinking like, oh no, this is a case of a successful producer and writer who's been, basically given his head nobody's there to edit and chop things up properly. But that was not the case at all. I mean, I still think it was a bit of a stumble coming out of the gate, but they certainly picked themselves up and hit their stride very quickly once they got past that.
Very good, very good. All right, well, we are going to go ahead then and hit our mid-show break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the lowest scoring episodes of the week. So stay tuned. All right. Well, let's see here. We are going to go ahead and start off with our bottom three of the week. And some familiar faces, but number three out of the bottom three is a bit of a surprise for us. And unfortunately, it's the return of a show from a bit of a hiatus in a low slot here. Coming in at Dead Average 7.0 is Grimm, Season 4, Episode 14, Bad Luck. Nick and Hank investigate the murder of a man who was found with his foot cut off, apparently as part of some Vezin ritual for good luck. But in order to find the culprit, Monroe and Rosalie need to go undercover. Meanwhile, Nick's still reeling from the fallout of Adeline and Juliet's showdown, and he ends up on a path to Henrietta. I give this one a 7.5, but Gary gave it a 6.5, and I don't know if Gary came back on after being off for a little bit, but Gary, not the best return for Grimm.
Oh geez, no! And I typically favor this show a lot. I'd probably score it higher than most because I do enjoy it so much. But geez, this was a rough one. The Vessin, who you're talking about in the recap, where his foot is cut off, he's a rabbit Vessin, so his foot is a good luck charm. It hurt right there.
Yeah,
it hurt a lot, and later turned out. In case they've been twisted enough, it's a good luck for fertility, of course, you know, rabbits. Yeah. So that was a little cheesy. I think even for this show, it felt like they jumped, maybe not a shark, but definitely a minnow. And then the whole way that Nick seems to be handling Juliet's issue, it feels out of character to me to some extent. I'm not saying he's not driven in his cause. Most of the time, friends or lovers, I guess in this case with Juliet, he usually seems to, you know, sort of keep his, I want to say almost common sense about himself, where, you know, he doesn't really isolate them or sort of cast them to the side. And I really had that feeling with Juliet. So, you know, I wasn't thrilled with that part of it. I mean, there were cute things like Monroe and Rosalie, you know, going undercover, and I'll admit that was a little cute. And who is it? Is it Cho? No.
Not exactly sure. Are you talking about
the police officer that they?
Oh, geez. See, now I'm not going to be able to remember it either because you. But I know who you're talking about.
I played Noel. Yeah. Anyway, and his constant gung ho ness over the Grimms now after being almost committed to an insane asylum over it about six episodes ago is still rather humorous as well. But it's just like I said, the Vessin of the week was kind of. It was just late. I just felt it was a little cheesy even for this show, especially for this show, because I think in some respects they don't try to, you know, cheese us too much with some of these people, but this one was over the top for me. And for the way that Nick's treating Juliet, I mean, I understand that he'd like to have her cured, but something just doesn't feel right about the whole thing. Did Nick seem out of character with that?
I do agree with you, and that's one of the things that bothered me as well. You know, four seasons in, I expect that they're going to run out of a few ideas, and there's going to be some clunkers when it comes to the Vezin of the Week and all of that. And this one definitely was, but then usually it's the character stuff that, and it's Officer Wu, I believe.
Wu.
Yes, and yeah, I love that too. I mean, the actor has waited so long to be able to actually be part of the, you know, the Team Grimm, and now that his character is there, he is just playing it up to the hilt. But I felt like both Nick and Juliet were a little bit out of character on the whole thing. Now, maybe for her, it makes sense for her to be a bit defensive about everything because she's the one who is now having to deal with this change more than anybody. But I would think that for someone who has become friends with so many different type of Vezin and is comfortable with that, and knows that there could be side effects and repercussions and all of that, that he would be a little bit more balanced in his response. But even she was like really just going at him and misinterpreting even his hesitation as a bit over the, in a bit of an over top way. You know, she basically is like, so you can live with this, and goes and, you know, Vogue's right in front of him. And he's like, obviously not ready for that or still adjusting to it. And the minute that he kind of flinches a little bit, she's just like, so kiss me. Come on. Can't you do it? And it's like, chill out. He's not rejecting you. He's, you know, it's like, I think both of them were overreacting. And unfortunately, the writers really have a bad habit of having the Nick and Juliet especially overreact to each other way too much. And for her character, it's also become a bit of a trope for her that she overanalyzes his response or lack thereof. I think it would have been perfectly natural for him to be like, I need time to think about this and to absorb it. Now's not a great time, but let me see what the options are, because maybe this isn't the way it needs to be. And of course, just saying that is not rejecting her. It's saying, let's see what our options are. And, so it's a big mess, and I don't think either one of them were written particularly well, and that bothered me. That was the thing that stuck for me from the episode, just like you were saying. It was, like, blatant. So that took a little bit away, and clearly it took a little bit more away for you, but that is why, in my opinion, this definitely was deserving to be in the bottom three this week.
Oh, I know. I agree. Typically come back strong, so this was a letdown in that sense, too.
Yeah, definitely. Let's see, then. The next one that we have is a show that is, unfortunately, so far, just kind of wallowing where it is. I keep waiting for it to kind of step up a little bit, and that is Dig, Season 1, Episode 3, The Rosenbergs, Peter's Pursuit of Khalid, Dead Ends, and he and Cohn follow clues found in Emma's journal. In other events, Debbie takes Josh for an unauthorized outing, and Evram continues his journey to Jerusalem. So this episode got an average of 6.75. And I'd have to check, but I think that may be just another episode that is remarkably consistent around the average or just under mark. And Edmund, you seem to not like this one either.
Yeah, what I'm finding odd is, especially for something that is this limited special event series, that here we are three episodes in, and I'm still getting the same issue of just feeling this complete disconnect between these different stories that they're running. In terms of it still feels to me like three, it's the three different shows, and we check in on Israel and the police investigation and New Mexico and the weird culty stuff going on there. And of course our red heifer, on the ship, which yes, we know is certainly part of the prophecy, et cetera. But even just in terms of the tone of the different elements, too much of it is feeling very rote. Certainly that whole attempted escape, and she gets on the phone, it's, oh, of course she's an addict, so her relative or whoever, the her former significant other, doesn't want to give her help, and oh, look, the ambassador is in league with the other evil people, or the people we assume are evil at the moment, and of course as much as I've loved David Coscubiela's work over the years, and especially in the last five, 6 years or so, he's just feeling like standard, manipulative, smiling, religious nut, basically. If this is an ongoing series, this is sort of where you'd say, oh, okay, well, they're still trying to find themselves, but no, I mean, it's supposed to be this limited series. Of course, we also know who's involved at the top, so it's perhaps not surprising that it's not really coming together. Tim Kring, et cetera.
Now, here's something weird, okay?
Yeah.
There are, apparently, according to my wife and others, tons of people who are watching this show who are like super into the mythology of it. They are like talking about it on Lost-esque levels. Sorry, Gary. But what I mean there is that they're like dissecting this show and trying to like figure out what all this stuff could mean. And I'm not sure I understand in what universe what show they're watching, because number one, the previews tell you what it's all about.
Yes.
and two, very little of that's in the show has actually gotten you in that direction so far. There's a lot of red herrings about stuff here. It's a lot of stuff that's going to amount to nothing, because you know what it's all supposed to add up to. So maybe it's – here's my theory. There's a whole lot of people, I think, that watch the show and enjoy it because they don't know where it's going, or they haven't figured it out yet.
Mm-hmm.
Where if you know where it's going and you're also familiar with the executive producer, and you're basically maybe a little bit jaded from watching other shows do this far better in terms of kicking off the story quick, maybe that's just the difference in our perspective. But from what I understand, looking out there, there are other people that feel the same way that we do. So there must be this really strange dichotomy. It may be the same difference between the people that are kind of half dreading the return of heroes versus the people who are over the moon over the return of heroes. There's not a whole lot of people that are ambivalent about it. So it's maybe the same kind of thing. But I did find that odd. I was like, really? There's people who are, you know, digging into the show, no pun intended? Like, seriously? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I must admit, I did sort of notice since of course they do love hyping the show in the commercial breaks for the show. But when some of the quotes they were able to pull and were putting up there, I think the one that really stood out for me was one review saying Da Vinci Code meet your match, and I was like, well, aside from the fact that's not a very high bar,
right?
I'm not sure even I could even say that. But
spoon-fed fiction has met its match. Maybe. Yeah, that's exactly right. It doesn't exactly throw out there any major bars to clear, does it? Anyway, be that as it may, it did come in number two. Yeah. So there is a show that, once again, consistently is just not hitting the mark.
Yep.
And even this week, even seeing it as a somewhat of a satirical, farcical type of story didn't quite help.
No.
And Edmund, if you could please.
Certainly. And this is, surprise, surprise, once again, Helix, Season 2, Episode 10, Mother. At the Abbey, Sister Amy makes a bargain for immortality. And in the woods, the race to find the bleeding tree intensifies now that Kyle is infected.
Dun, dun, dun. Yeah, it came in at an average of 6.25, which is actually nowhere near the lowest for the season, but is a bit of a drop from the last two or three episodes.
Yep.
And Edmund, you gave it a 6, and I gave it a 6.5, so we're not exactly far off here. But I'm curious to see if you found it wanting for the same reasons I did.
Well, I guess certainly the whole chase through the woods and Kyle getting infected and going nuts just felt particularly rote. After the way Sister Amy had been giving us the crazy the last couple of episodes, even that felt like it was starting to lose steam a little bit as she's trying to manipulate her way into having to put on the silver contacts, just like her co-stars.
Yeah, you know, I tend to wonder whether or not she's going to wear them quite as well, but that's beside the point. She's got, you know, already a shine in her eyes from the crazy,
yeah.
So it may be overdoing it a bit. That's part of it. Frankly, I think it was doing fine, but it just was like you said, there were some rote elements. Just the long walk through the woods that seemed to go nowhere fast was like, okay, that's fine, but you're not doing anything. And if you're going to really rely on your crazy in order to keep your momentum going, then you kind of have to keep going. You can't stop because then you just look bad. And then there was that last scene, which I felt like was grotesque for the sake of grotesque. And I don't know if they knew better or if I could say if I didn't know better, because I don't know better, but it came across as disturbingly misogynist, to say the least. If it wasn't for the fact that there was a woman kind of driving somebody to do it, it would have been even worse. But man, that was just really over the top. This whole idea of basically it's if this were, you know, like a televised version of Dune and that was the Ben Aeth Lalax, then that would be one thing. But
yeah,
a birthing crutch on Helix is disturbing,
yes.
To say the least. Yeah. So and then as soon as the woman gives birth while being chained to some kind of wooden, you know, chassis, they're ritualistically. Their throats are slashed. I mean, it was just way, way over the top.
Mm-hmm.
And that just left such a bad taste in my mouth at the very end. It was like, this was an average episode right up until then. And then it was like, they're kind of lucky I didn't go lower.
Yeah.
Just on that note. But anyway, I don't know how much that bothered you too or what, but it certainly was unnecessary in my mind. And yes, this is a show that is kind of leaning on its reputation for being over the top, but that was I think, going a bit far.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, there's bringing the crazy, and then there's just being in bad taste, and they definitely crossed that line, and especially after an episode that had been so lackluster leading up to that.
Yeah, exactly. So we'll just have to see whether or not Helix can kind of come out of this spiral. I'm not really sure because this show has never really been above average in any way. It has always been barely holding on to itself, and its downward fall. In fact, I went back and I was looking at some of my comments on the first season on VogNetwork.com, and that is in fact what I said, is that it was a downward spiral, and it just continues to do that. That said, this season is slightly better than last season in terms of score, as far as I can tell. Slightly? Okay.
Yeah, I was going to say, it can't be by much, but...
No. Slightly,
and that's even, you know, that's even given the fact that you had that slight uptick, as you said, in the last few weeks, which I don't seem to remember them really having last season. It was just kind of disjointed, and we couldn't figure out what the heck they were trying to do pretty much from the beginning last season.
Yeah, well, I do want to continue to say, because I don't want, you know, like Danger Mouse has said before, like, why, if this is consistently your bottom show, are you watching it? This is the bottom show of the shows that we actually care to watch. There are other shows that have dropped off, and this one is definitely in the danger of being completely cut off.
Mm-hmm.
I think, did they say it got renewed for a third season? I certainly don't remember, and I don't care that if it did or not. But this one, I think I'm just kind of running through to the end just to see where we go from here. They've at least got me hooked that much to see how bad it can get, or how crazy they can go. But this is not the kind of show that is so dreadfully horrible that we would have dropped it already.
Yeah.
Because there are shows this year that did fall into that category. I mean, Allegiance was one of them. I looked this up before. There were other shows in the last year. American Horror Story.
Right.
Surprisingly. A show that was doing rather well and had always done, you know, at least, approaching above average, and just fell completely off the rails in its fourth season. And just really, nobody wanted to even touch it. But that became kind of a widely recognized problem for that show. Extant, for instance, another show that mm-hmm. we just kind of dropped off the radar with, and yes. Dominion. So there are shows out there that
we will give up on, definitely.
Yeah, exactly. There are shows that we will give up on if they get that bad. Helix is definitely a show that is in danger of me not really catching up on it. Mm-hmm. Beyond this season, it's in a once upon a time type of situation right now.
Yeah,
for sure. It's there are a few shows like that. Frankly, at this point, if Dig is a limited series, I'd happily watch through the end. If it somehow gets renewed for a second season, it better improve dramatically for me to want to come back to it.
Yeah, absolutely.
But if it's a self-contained show, one season, I'm willing to let it run through and see how it does. But, you know, it's all situational here.
Yeah, although with Dig, when you were mentioning that it's generating all this buzz, which I wasn't really aware of, I mean, I'm assuming that must be somewhat reflected in the ratings. So I am getting a little worried now that, oh no, they're going to think that, yes, they have more there than they do.
Hmm. Yeah, that's it. There may be... And quite frankly, there are shows that simply are not really made for us.
Yeah.
They may be genre to a certain extent, but they are really not meant for an audience that knows their genre stuff. They're meant for very much a wider audience. And maybe that's why a comparison to something like, The Da Vinci Code is not a bad one. Dan Brown is very popular. He dabbles in science fiction and other stuff, but in terms of doing it well... Clearly, we have a very different opinion than the masses do.
Yeah, and just FYI, I just did a little quick Googling, and there has been no decision made on Helix. So, we will have to wait and see for one of our later news shows when we can.
Yes, I suppose we will. Yeah, believe me, you'll hear it from us, even if you don't read it somewhere else first. All right, well, I think we're going to go ahead then and wrap this show up. Next time, we will have our wrap-up show, basically, where we go over all the shows that were between the top and bottom. And in this case, we have a number of shows here. I would say around 13 or so, 12 or 13. And all of them are in a range between 7.38 and 8. So that tells you, yeah, there's not a whole lot of difference between shows that were right out of the top slot and right out of the bottom slot. Or you could put say it differently. The top and the bottom really distinguished themselves this week.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google Plus under The Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as fair use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time, watch, read, and listen, and believe in the critical myth.